Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Okay.
Hello.
Okay, you guys ready?
Yeah.
Hey there, my name is Chris.
Amanda.
Nick.
This is a podcast made for a science communication course at Simon Fraser University.
And created with CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people. So back in the fall of 2018, I was sitting in an archaeology class with our instructor, Dr. Dennis Sandgate.
Okay, before I get started, does anybody have any questions or concerns?
And he was telling us about the three women who pioneered field studies on the great apes.
The person who probably is the most responsible for this is Jane Goodall,
who studied chimpanzees in the 1960s.
He started going out as a very young, not even a graduate student, very young, 20-something.
Diane Fossey, who studied mountain gorillas in 1966.
And she unfortunately died. She was killed by poachers when she was trying to protect the gorillas from poachers.
And by Ruth Galdikas.
She began, I think, in 1971, studying orangutans on the island of Borneo, and she still does that.
Our professor then mentioned that by Ruth Galdikas teaches here at SFU, which absolutely blew my mind. And I couldn't believe that she was here around campus, so I thought, we absolutely have to talk to her and her past experiences working with orangutans in Borneo, especially with the issues of deforestation and palm oil production that's currently on the news. And a few months later, this happened.
So, okay, 1, 2, 3. So this is like a regular radio station. I've been in a few.
Today we have a huge privilege of speaking with Dr. Galdikas. She is a professor at Simon Fraser University in BC, Canada. She has been researching and working with orangutans for almost 50 years, and with the exception of Jane Goodall, has conducted the longest continuous study of any wild mammal in the world. She has received the prestigious Kalpataru Award, given by the Republic of Indonesia for outstanding environmental leadership, and is the only person of non-Indonesian birth to receive the award. She has written countless scientific articles and reviews, being featured twice on the cover of National Geographic and the IMAX film titled Born to be Wild. She has published her autobiography titled Reflections of Eden, which highlights her experiences with the orangutans of Borneo. Dr. Galdikas, thank you for being here. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And yeah, so to begin, would like to know a little more about you. So why study orangutans? Where did this journey begin for you?
The journey began a long time ago. I think it began when I was a child. When I was a child, I was very interested in human origins. But when I was 5 years old, I wondered, where did humans come from? Where are we going? I lived in Toronto, and my parents had a large backyard with tall oak trees in it. And sometimes I was allowed to stay in the backyard and just, you know, I was able to gaze at the stars and just wonder. So that part of the journey began very early. I became interested in orangutans when I saw their photographs as a young adolescent. One of them probably was of a captive, a Sumatran male, in which if you didn't notice, you know, from the lower lip to the chin, if you just saw the upper face, you would have sworn he was human. The eyes were so human. Orangutans have whites around the iris of their eye. So that was one of the photographs that's still around. I think it first appeared in an old Life book, one of the books published by whoever published Life magazine or something like that. There's other photographs of orangutan infants you know, two or three infants with their hair standing up on end, little Einsteins, looked as though they'd plugged their fingers into an electric jack. And again, the wide eyes, they're so human-like. So, and I started reading about them, and basically when I was an adolescent, virtually nothing was known about them. And that, of course, intrigued me even more. And then, as I got a little bit older, primatologists did start going out to the field. Jane Goodall was among one of the pioneers. She went out in 1960 and started studying the great apes in Africa, but nobody really studied the orangutans. So it was the two things, that they looked very human, and also that they were so mysterious and enigmatic. So that's where my journey began.
She goes on to tell us that there was little research on orangutans back then compared to African apes because
Africa is much closer to us in the sense that we all know about the vast numbers of animals in Africa. We know those animals. The elephants, for instance, the wild elephants of Africa. And also, Africa's always been more accessible. I mean, there's been, you know, colonial enterprises going on between Europe and Africa for, you know, a few centuries. Southeast Asia doesn't really have that many wide open spaces. Southeast Asia until recently was covered by tropical rainforests, jungles. It was a part of the world that we really didn't interact with very much. It wasn't a place where people of European heritage felt kind of they could just go in. It wasn't kind of open to our North American and European sensibilities. And jungle, it's jungle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, jungle is much, much harder to work in than savannah. So it kind of conspires, in a sense, to keep you out, to keep the stranger, the foreigner, out.
In addition, the solitary and arboreal nature of the orangutans made it difficult for researchers to follow them through the dense jungle. But in 1971, Dr. Galdegus took the big leap.
We would like to know what it was like for you when you first arrived in the jungles of Kalimantan in Borneo.
Oh, it was very hard physically. But it was also, you know, when you enter a primary rainforest in which there are very few people. There's almost an ecstatic kind of quality to be able to actually be in nature, be totally in nature. You're in the middle of one of the greatest jungles in the world. Your main interactions are with orangutans, who are very human-like, and they're not particularly aggressive. No, it was just, it's hard even to describe what it was like. It's like, when I think about it, it was like being in another galaxy far, far away. It doesn't have any connection to, you know, us sitting here at SFU, this modern world.
But she was very quickly faced with the logistic challenges of working in a remote tropical rainforest.
So it was, there were no telephones. The only way that you could get to our camp was by river. So sometimes what happened is that the vegetation on either side of the riverbank would sort of sever, the roots would sever, be released from the riverbank. And so the vegetation would float downriver and it would clog. So sometimes we had clogs that were 100 meters long. And so you could see people on the other side of the clog. But if you shouted at them, you couldn't hear them because they were so far away. And so sometimes it was impossible to get in and out of our camp for a month. And we didn't have telephones. Telephones did not exist in that part of Borneo. We did not start getting landlines until the late 1990s. And then, of course, you know, a year later, everybody had a cell phone. Some cell phones came in the beginning of the century to Borneo. I mean, that's how isolated Borneo was. There were no roads. The first roads actually started being built in Borneo in the 1980s and the 1990s. And you'd travel along the road, and then all of a sudden it would come to an end, and you'd be in a, your car would be stuck in a, you know, like 2 feet of mud. And you couldn't go anywhere until a truck came by. So until then, you either walked or you went by boat, by dugout canoe or by small motorboat. So we paddled. So the early days, especially when our motor broke down, we didn't have a, we had an inboard motor, it would break down and we'd have to paddle 14 hours to get to the closest town.
In terms of food?
So it was very hard. There were no real stores in the town, so you couldn't really get anything to eat. So we were eating a lot of, well, what you could get sardines, canned sardines. And then we would get, the local people sometimes would come by and give us fish. Now, we didn't have to buy it. They would just give it to us. And in return, what they sometimes took from us was tin cans. And they would use them to make little lamps. You know, they'd put oil and then a cloth wick. So it was kind of, you didn't even have a cash economy, really. It was just beginning.
But the worst part for her was...
the diseases. I kept a diary of every time I felt sick. And when I looked back on it, it was like every day there was another infection. There were mosquito bites, you know, mysterious fevers. I mean, malaria, typhoid, you know, all kinds of things. Dengue. I got dengue twice. I mean, it was like nonstop.
Oh, wow.
That's that's a lot of...
Yeah, no, I think I got every tropical disease known to... most of the tropical diseases known to humankind in Southeast Asia.
And so what kept you persevering through all of that?
Well, several things. Initially, I knew I had to stay to get my PhD. And I had talked to a friend who had just come back from 2 years in New Guinea, in Papua. And, oh my gosh, the stories that he told in his village in the year and a half or almost 2 years that he was there, just in his village alone, three people died of snake bite. And more were, you know, were bitten. I forget exactly what I said to him, but something like, oh, it's going to be so hard. You know, what if I don't make it? What if we don't make it? I mean, just a rhetorical question. And he just looked at me sternly and said, you'll make it. He said, you have no choice. and that's exactly how he made it. Right. You have no choice. So that was the first thing, that I knew my mother would be disappointed. Because she was counting on me getting a PhD. She was a nurse. But the second thing was that I really wanted to know, I really wanted to understand the life histories of these wild orangutans that I was becoming familiar with. And then the third reason started coming up as I was staying in Borneo. And that is, I knew if I left, if we left, then that forest would be destroyed and those orangutans would end up dead. And it became very obvious that our presence there helped protect that forest, which eventually became a national park. People would say to me, they said, well, as long as you're here, we're not going to destroy the forest, but the moment you leave, it's gone. And the reason was, it's very interesting, the reason was because the local people felt that we were keeping the big-time logging companies out, which we were, because the big-time logging companies had to get their permissions from Jakarta, and, you know, from the national government. And as long as the national government didn't give them logging concessions, they were reluctant to start logging. So if you read my book, Reflections of Eden, I talk a little bit about that, about how the head of nature conservation and forest protection actually kind of traded off our area, our forest where we worked, for another forest in another national park. And I've always felt a debt to that national park, which was virtually destroyed by illegal logging and gold mining, but now it's coming back. So that became the ultimate reason why we had to stay. As long as we stayed, there was some assurance that that wild orangutan population would be relatively safe.
And so, ever since 1971, she's been traveling back and forth to Borneo.
Can you tell us more about some orangutan behavior or ecology?
Well, orangutans are not like other apes. When they grow up, they tend to become solitary or semi-solitary. So they travel alone, the females with their offspring, and usually they only have one because the older one has gone off. Sometimes they have the two. They have the newborn infant or the young infant on their bodies, and then an older offspring, which might be a young adolescent. They have very long birth intervals, probably the longest birth interval of any mammal on this planet. So on average, in our area, the birth interval is 8 years. The infant is basically carried for the first 5 years of life, and he spends, or she spends, most of his or her time with the mother. He or she may have an older sibling, that the older sibling is usually gone or not much around by the time that he or she is born, because the older sibling would be about 8 or 9 years of age, venturing forth. So the bond is intensive, and part of the intensity is due to the fact that nobody else is around. And the interesting thing about orangutans is that because they're so individualistic, when you get into a relationship with them, a free relationship, I don't necessarily mean a captive one, but, with free-ranging or orangutans, you don't have to penetrate through their species. You can relate to them, and they relate to you as one individual to another. So I'll give you an example. I remember once I was in a zoo, and I was allowed to go into the back area, and there was a gorilla male silverback in a cage. And there was an orangutan adult male in another cage. I mean, they knew I worked with orangutan, and they knew if an orangutan bit my finger, that it would be my fault, not theirs, right? Anyway, so I'm feeding the adult male orangutan raisins, right? And I'm putting my fingers right into his mouth, his open mouth. You know, my fingers are in his mouth, maybe up to the second knuckle. You know, half the fingers in there. And I'm thinking, I don't even know this orangutan. Like, why am I doing this? But doesn't matter. You know, he's taking the raisins. And I noticed that the silverback gorilla was watching very intently. So I thought, well, maybe he wants raisins. I think he did. So I walked over there, and I kind of, you know, raising my hand, kind of motioned that I was going to give him a raisin. And he just went berserk. I mean, he was, you know, going from one end of this cage to another. He was banging the, you know, the bars of his cage so much that I thought he was going to pull them out of their sockets. I mean, he had to show me that he was a gorilla, and that I was just too presumptuous just to come up to him and hand him a raisin, you know? So we had to work through his gorillaness. But, I mean, the orangutan didn't bother. Like, you know, here was somebody giving him raisins, and, you know, why should he demonstrate that he's an orangutan and I'm a human? You know, it was a total different kind of sensibility. And I think it's because orangutans, even though obviously they're orangutans, but first they're individuals. And so that makes it possible to have relations with them that tend to be more like human relations, I think. I mean, they kind of open themselves up to you.
And that's not the only thing we have in common.
And let me tell you, nothing does it for an orangutan as much as good food. Well, because their whole lives are about food, and that's why they're solitary. So the orangutans are ripe fruit eaters, and they eat the succulent, sweet flesh of fruits. And that's why fruits are brightly colored and sweet, you know, so seed dispersers will eat them. And you can enter a fruit tree, and if it's full of ripe fruit, you can eat all the fruit. But if there's two orangutans, then you only get half the tree. If there's three, you only get a third of the tree. So over the countless generations, orangutans have gotten bigger. They're the largest arboreal animal. And they go into a tree, and I have seen them sit for 8 hours in a tree, eating all the ripe fruit, while their sister, sibling, you know, is half a kilometer away in her own tree. And also this goes to mating. So an orangutan female has a tree, she's sitting in a tree, and an adult male shows up. And he's two or three times as big as she is, because he has to fight other males to get access to females. Now, I mentioned that orangutans only give birth once every 8 years. So that means they come into receptivity, or proceptivity, like they want to mate, only during a very short period, every 8 years. So if you're an adult male, you're only going to mate. You're only going to have that window, that very narrow window. So he shows up. He's 300 pounds, she's 90 pounds, she's sitting in a tree. And what does she think? She thinks, go away. Don't eat my food. Don't eat my fruit. And so when she's receptive and wants to mate, then she's willing to tolerate him. And so they'll travel together for several days, mate. Of course, the male tends to initiate the mating if it's an adult female. But then maybe on the fourth or fifth morning, the male wakes up in his nest. He usually makes his nest close to where the female has made her nest. And he looks around, and she's gone. Where is she? You know, he looks here, looks there. He long calls, and then long calls to announce his presence. You know, he's calling her. She's nowhere to be seen, because she left in the middle of the night. She left early morning before he woke up, because she does not, now that mating's over, she's satisfied, she's done, she doesn't want to share her fruit with him. And it's very interesting, because sometimes when the males and the female consort, the male tends not to eat so much. He spends more time just sitting there watching her. It's almost like he's fascinated by her. He can't get enough of her. Yeah. She's food for his body, kind of, food for his thoughts. But I think he is watching her. Maybe because he's fascinated, but maybe he doesn't want her to escape. Because, you know, she might make a run for it. It's all about food. You know, it's interesting. You watch orangutans, and they're so different from humans. They're such extraordinary animals. And they're, you know, very gentle, meditative, serene most of the time. And they live in a different world. And unfortunately, that world is dissolving. It's coming to an end for them. And this is what keeps me in the field. I mean, that's the reason. I don't want them to go extinct as populations in the wild.
However, in early 1971, Dr. Galdikas' work didn't just involve researching orangutans.
Actually, the first month that I got there, we started rescuing captive orangutans, wild-born captive orangutans, from a life as a pet or in captivity. And we started, you know, raising them, and then the rest of them were quite young. These were usually people's pets or intended to be people's pets. And so we started rescuing wild-born ex-captive orangutans, and we have now released close to 1,000 back, well, maybe not 1,000, 600 or 700 in the 50 years that I've been there, almost 50 years back to the wild. And most of them have prospered. But now the problem is there's not enough forest to release them. We can't find, we have almost 300 wild boar ex-captive orangutans in our facilities. We have 14 release stations where we release them. But now it's like there's no more forest because the forests outside the national park are being annihilated. Millions of hectares of tropical rainforest have been cut down in Southeast Asia and are beginning to be cut down in Africa and in South America, Central America, for palm oil. And of course, you know, part of the effect of all those forests being cut down and burned is all the carbon dioxide that gets emitted into the world's atmosphere, which of course contributes to global warming.
In fact, 174 tons of CO2 are released every year into the atmosphere for every hectare of tropical rainforest destroyed in Indonesia and Malaysia.
Palm oil is a real problem. It's basically an African weed. That's where it came from. And when I say it's a weed, archaeologists in our department here at SFU who work with African agriculture say that you can't really tell when it became domesticated because it kind of followed the villagers around. That village was established and there was palm oil that grew up around it. And that's because palm oil is a very hardy plant. And this has made it the most widely used vegetable oil on the planet. It's cheap to grow. As I said, it's a weed. You get enough. All it needs is sunlight and enough water and some fertility in the soil. Now, if there's palm oil from sustainable sources, that would be wonderful. But the problem is, they often say, oh, this is sustainable palm oil. And I think, what do they mean? They cut down a forest, burned a forest, killed all the orangutans inadvertently or advertently, and they say it's sustainable. Sustainable for what? Well, sustainable for the palm oil. You know, so there is sustainable palm oil, but it's found in little-known places like small landholders in Ecuador, where small landholders have converted, just changed their crops. You know, those fields have been utilized by the Incas and the previous people for hundreds of years, if not thousands. And so these Andean farmers, whatever, have changed to palm oil because palm oil is so lucrative. Okay, that's sustainable. Because if those forests were cut 1,000 years ago, what are you going to do? But if those forests were cut 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, I think that's a different story. And if the orangutans were extirpated 20, 30 years ago, that's not sustainable. So I try not to eat palm oil as much as I can. The problem is, you know, it's the great pretender. So when you see vegetable oil on a package, it almost invariably means palm oil. Because those people who produce canola oil or, you know, sunflower oil or olive oil are very proud of those oils because those are expensive oils. You know, they're not cheap. They're rare, relatively rare. Avocado oil, you know, lots of oils.
Yeah, I've always wondered that, too. Like, why is it not labeled, right, on the package? Like, it's, you just say vegetable oil or, like, hydrogenated oil, but it's like you always know, like, yeah, it comes from palm oil, right?
Yeah,
inevitably in the end, right? It's just,
it's cheap, but it's
got to be some kind of pressure from the consumers, right? That we got to say, like, label this, right? Tell us, you know, inform us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you eat clean, which is avoid processed food, then you don't have to use palm oil. I mean, some of the things I really tried to do is cut down on the processed food. And I remember when I consciously made an effort to avoid palm oil, which occurred a few years ago, I lost 5 pounds in 2 weeks. Like, I mean, that told me something. Palm oil isn't particularly healthy for you either.
Yes.
If you've had a heart attack.
There's been links to, like, cardiovascular diseases.
Well, if you've had a heart attack, they tell you not to to use it. And, of course, as humans fragment their forests and diminish their forests, they're changing. her distress.